Welcome, everyone, to episode number 103 of Underserved. Joining me today is Emma Patke, VP of Software Engineering at Align Technology. Let's get started.
Welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry, where we focus on stories of tech industry leaders, their insights, and their lessons learned. And now, your host, Andrew Jalina.
Emma, thank you so much for joining us today on Underserved.
Hi, Andrew. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here and excited.
Very good. Now, you grew up in Bombay, and you said on the pre-call, like some other folks who grew up over there, your parents said there was only two legitimate professions. What were they?
Yeah. So growing up in Bombay in a family full of engineers and doctors, there were only two professions, Andrew. It was either you take medicine or you take engineering. You know, and my older sister, she's 5 years older than me, and she's a doctor. Sort of watching her in med school, I knew for sure that I didn't want to be a doctor. The work was too hard. It seemed like the study hours were too long. And so I decided to pick engineering school.
The doctor thing, I mean, God bless them, but like doing your undergrad and then grad work and residency and all that stuff, it just seems so hard.
Yeah, it's just a lot of studying, a lot of rigor that, I don't know, I just looked at and I was like, I don't think I can do that.
So you did a little basic programming in high school?
Yes. So computers was just kicking off and we had an optional class they offered of basic programming in the ninth grade. And so you could take that. And that's where I picked up basic. I remember my first basic computer and, you know, the keyboard and all of that. Very cool. So started to work on basic programming and then decided, you know, to take electrical engineering. I'll tell you a little story there. You know, we finished high school and in India in those days, it was 1989. So everyone was forced ranked with their results. And we were sitting in a big auditorium and you got to fill up a form with your choice of engineering major. There was no computer science offered, no computer engineering offered. So most people picked electronics engineering as their top choice, which I did too. And then I picked electrical engineering. And the person running the admissions would basically announce your name and would tell you what major you got because it was just forced rank. They went down the list, they picked your first choice. They told you when a major was full. So I remember sitting in the auditorium, hearing the fact that the electronics engineering major was full and thinking to myself, oh my God, I hope I get electrical because I really didn't want to do mechanical, which was my third choice. And thank God, yeah, I did get electrical. I heard my name. I heard him say electrical engineering and off you went to the next person. So that's how I got electrical engineering.
So towards the end of your undergrad, you were able to get on a project with a mentor. What was that like?
Yeah. So we had a choice to pick a project in a related field. It didn't have to be in electrical engineering. We found ourselves a mentor at the Bhabha Atomic Research Center in Mumbai. And our mentor wanted us to build a program that electronics engineers could use to essentially create a visual circuit. So they have a circuit in mind, they want to pull transistors, capacitors, other electronic components, but they can drag and drop them sort of from a widget of libraries and then create that circuit. We loved the idea. We decided to use C as our programming language. Since we hadn't learned anything in school, we decided to teach ourselves C from books. And, you know, C is a lot of memories and pointers and memory allocations. We thought we did a really great job. And, you know, we tested this program at my dad's office because there was no computers anywhere. And it was special to have a PC then. So my dad had one in his office. And we tested the program and we were ready to go for our demo day.
And what happens on demo day?
So demo day, you know, I have to tell you, turned out to be a little different than what we had envisioned. So we tested the program, very confident, walked into our mentor's office at the research center, you know, executed the program. And nothing came up. And so we did a DIR, it was a DOS operating system, and nothing came up. And we were like, oh, he's got to have some files on the file system, no? Why aren't they showing up? So we pull him into the room and we're like, hey, we're doing a DIR. And he's like, what do you mean? There's no files. And we're like, I don't know. Don't you have any files? And he's like, of course I do. I've got all my information there. I don't know what exactly we did even to date, but our program managed to wipe out his hard drive. And, you know, I guess we got ourselves into some kind of a memory heap space that was technically not allowed to get into, but we somehow got into it and we managed to erase, I guess, write over all his files.
Wow.
it was needless to say, he was really, really upset, asked us to leave. But I think he later on felt bad for us and agreed to sign our project report, which honestly allowed us to graduate. So super forever thankful for that.
He did you a solid. You wiped his hard drive and he still let you graduate.
He did. I think he realized that, you know, 18-year-olds are what they're going to do. He didn't want to hold us back.
I mean, there's a reason that demo is like a four-letter word in software.
And even today, right? You do demos and things work and they don't.
That's scary stuff. So despite that, you said, you know what? I'm not going to be scared of this. I'm going to continue my studies. Where do you go?
Yeah, so I enrolled at the University of Southern California in LA for my master's in computer engineering. It was a largely hardware course, but we were allowed to take several classes from the School of Computer Science. And once again, you know, I decided to do that, did a lot of programming in C and found a number of great courses and a great professor as well that I worked with quite extensively.
And who is she?
So this was Dr. Deborah Estrin, and she was part of the computer science department, and she was doing a lot of research with organizations, as well as with companies, in the Internet Engineering Task Force. It was a consortium that was set up with a bunch of companies really figuring out how we leverage the internet. She specifically was working on figuring out protocols for the transport of audio and video. You know, audio and video conferencing was just starting to pick up then, and internet bandwidth wasn't as freely available as it is today. And so it was a challenge to figure out how you build interoperable video and audio players, but also be sure of some bandwidth that you would get along the way. And so we built two protocols within the IETF. One was called RTP. It's a real-time transport protocol, which is essentially allows you to send packets over the internet, audio, video, but in a way that you can interoperate with any other player that is using the same protocol. And then there was another one called RSVP, which was a resource reservation protocol, which was essentially you mapped out the route from your sender to your receiver. And along that route, in each router, you reserved bandwidth for that application. And you literally told the router, here's the amount of bandwidth I need for my application. And the router reserved that. And then, you know, using your IP address and other things, it would, when you sent the packets, give you that allocation. Or it would tell you when you reserve that there's nothing available.
So you're kind of saying along the whole route between two computers, hey, every router, can you hold the door open for me?
Yep, that's what we had to do then because there wasn't free bandwidth available.
I've still seen RTP referenced in like streaming protocols and setting things up to this day. So you were definitely on the bleeding edge of setting up these protocols.
Yeah, no, it was great. It was just a lot of research, a lot of discussions. And, you know, the nice part was the interoperability. I think people got together to build something that they realized it's the internet and you really have to build something that's interoperable. And it's sometimes different in the corporate world, but we really got to see people come together to build that standard protocol.
You are listening to the Underserved Podcast. Underserved is produced by Maris Consulting Group, embracing the power of people in technology. For more information, visit mariscg.com. That's MARISCG.com.
So does your grad school experience lead to a job?
Yes. Right after school, it was really honestly through Dr. Estrin. She was engaged with, as I said, a number of corporations, and Intel was building out their internet technology labs, very focused on audio and video conferencing and, you know, really harnessing the power of their chips. I got a job there as a software engineer at the internet technology labs in Portland, in Oregon.
So they're justifying their higher processing power and having you build stuff that'll sell more chips?
Yes. Essentially, that's what it was. And, you know, I think the work we did there eventually got absorbed into the Windows stack.
Yeah, you worked on PC RSVP, a Win32 service.
Exactly, building up on the protocol that we'd built out through the IETF. Really started using that protocol and built, media players that would use that protocol.
So if you're building for Windows, you got to be using either Visual Basic or Visual C++. I'm guessing the latter.
Visual C++, yes, absolutely. The IDE was fairly friendly, and it wasn't as intimidating sometimes as using Emacs and, you know, some of the editors. So we'd started there. That's where I started when I did C. It felt a lot more user-friendly.
But then Dr. Estrin found you another job after that, correct?
Yeah, so I wanted to move to the Bay Area in San Francisco. Sun Microsystems, specifically Javasoft, was really picking up then. I joined as a member of a technical staff at Sun Microsystems, but more specifically in their Javasoft group.
I mean, 97 to 99, like that is the birth of Java becoming mainstream. You couldn't have timed it any better.
No, I absolutely couldn't have. We were starting to build out the Java specification. Sun Microsystems had built a reference implementation of the JVM and had just put it out there for anyone and everyone to use. Companies started to build out their own JVMs for their operating systems and their hardware. For me personally, it was fascinating to see that there was a programming language where you could literally write once and then run it on any hardware in any operating system.
They must have been interested in your media and protocols background for that stack.
That's exactly right. So we built what was called then the Java Media Framework Specification. So once again, it was building up on what I'd done in the past, but it was a set of APIs that you could use to build out your Java Media Players, right? So as long as you use those APIs, you could plug in a Java Media Player into your overall Java runtime. You could plug in various audio and video decoders and algorithms that you wanted to use. And a player on the other side, a receiver on the other side, because the protocol was understood, knew how to interpret all the packets coming in and play back whatever you were sending.
You must have gotten sick of the stability of a full-time job and the wonderful weather in California, because then you go consult in Chicago.
That's right. That's right. You know, the reason I did that is I felt like I needed to really look at a breadth of industries, Andrew. You know, I think I'd spent so much time in protocols and systems engineering that I felt like I needed to step out of that and say, how do companies really use technology? How do they make a difference to their business processes? And yeah, I found a job at Inventa, which was a smaller consulting firm really focused on integration consulting. They were working with products like WebMethods and TIBCO and really working with clients to integrate their sort of legacy backends to sort of more modern e-commerce web frontends. So I spent 7 years there.
What are some of the different verticals you got exposed to there?
So lots of different, and that was the beauty of consulting. Healthcare, medical space, supply chain, paper manufacturing companies, you know, a lot of just different variety of industry experiences there. You know, but at the end of the day, all focused on sort of your back-end procurement processes, order to cash, supply chain, source to settle. So really learned a lot of those processes and a lot of what it means to exchange, you know, documents with your suppliers and with your vendors and with your customers for automating the back-end processes.
You also learned that sometimes as a consultant, you get thrown in the fire and have to rescue a project. You have a story about that?
Yes, I do. Yeah. So Abbott was my client back in North Chicago. And they'd been using Trading Networks, which was a product from WebMethods. They were really setting that up for their e-commerce orders coming in. And they'd had, I think, 2 or 3 attempts at going live with their setup. And each time, it just hadn't worked. And one of my groups within Inventa had also tried before this. So we were sort of on a really, you know, short leash. The customer was understandably very upset. And they sent me in. And I remember the first day I walked in and he was like, you know, this is the last chance we're giving you guys. This has really not been a great experience for us. I said, yep, I completely understand. I spent some time looking at the architecture and decided to flip the whole thing. You know, they kind of got an asynchronous model going where any number of threads could just make calls. And I think that was the reason they were having performance issues and the, you know, system was just crashing very soon after it came up. I changed it completely to a synchronous model, you know, just one thread at a time to begin with, taking in one request at a time. I knew it would take longer to process, but I figured that's what was overwhelming the system, was just not being able to control the throughput. So fix that. I remember I deployed it into production in the morning. 30 minutes into deploying it into production, the head of IT comes in and he says, hey, how's it going? And I said, well, the system looks stable. He said, well, that's much farther along than we've ever gotten in any of the deployments. So, you know, keeping our fingers crossed. By the end of the day, the system was absolutely stable. It was much slower in its overall throughput than it had been, but it was standing up and it was taking in orders and it was processing them. The client was extremely happy and thankful. But, you know, it makes you realize, right, that consulting, they're expecting a level of experience, a level of expertise that, you know, you gain because you go into these different situations and you learn different challenges and you solve different problems. And I think for me, that was what motivated me. That's exactly the reason I took consulting, is you get thrown in the fire, but then, you know, you just learn a lot and you're able to build on that learning.
I remember around the same time I was consulting. My boss from my consulting company had us on a project with TIBCO, and there was this whole like distributed architecture and how these messages were going to fly around. And he's like, you know what? We better hedge our bets. Let's use the bridge pattern from the Gang of Four book and we'll make it so you can either use the TIBCO stuff and be distributed or not and just make one giant linked synchronous executable. Guess which one made it to production?
Yes. Yes, yes. And, you know, we face those problems today too, right? As we design, you know, do you do queuing? Do you do synchronous? Do you do multiple queues? So, you know, that was honestly the genesis of a lot of that and looking at different patterns.
So you get your green card towards the end of that assignment and you got kind of a decision to make.
Yeah. So, you know, the green card really frees you. I think a lot of people have this experience of coming on a student visa to the US, needing to get your H-1, needing to keep your job, all of those things. And so once we got our green cards, we felt a sense of freedom.
Was that Intent Technologies?
So Intent Technologies actually was me wanting to go back to India. I actually tied up with a company in India that I could use. So outsourcing had just picked up in India. And a lot of companies were outsourcing sort of, you know, work that was more IT, keeping the lights on, integrations, that kind of work. And I was able to find a few folks with this company that I was able to hire and worked with one of my clients back in the US that I had worked with before I left for Bombay. And we were able to set up, you know, just sort of exactly the same work that we were doing, but just leverage the scale and the cost of working with folks from India, right? And so I think in the cost of what it took, you could only have one person perhaps in the US, we were able to have three in India. But then because we'd laid down the framework, because we'd laid down the process and sort of the code reviews, and we knew what we had to do to get good quality out, I was able to sort of scale that up with that company in India. So that actually worked really well. And the team there learned WebMethod, right? They learned something new. Even after I left there, they were able to continue with other clients and kind of, you know, set up that team there.
But when you move from India to the US, now back to India, do you notice any differences or like miss anything?
Oh, for sure. Oh my goodness. It had been close to 15 years since we'd left, and lots of different things, right? We'd gotten used to the way of life, so to speak, in the US, in terms of things just happening and things just working. And, you know, that's not how Mumbai is. You don't know, some days you'll take 2 hours to get somewhere. Some days you'll take 45 minutes or 30 minutes. And there was just a lot of the infrastructure and things that you take for granted that were still sort of, you know, making their way and finding their way through in Bombay. So yeah, a lot of differences there. But man, the boom of technology and some of these companies that were starting to do business process outsourcing, et cetera, was amazing to see. It was really the beginnings of outsourcing and offshore talent.
Hey, sport. How was school today?
It was okay, Dad. How was work?
Ugh. Actually, I had a rough day. Leading an engineering team is hard. I mean, I have to ship new software, meet deadlines, and tackle new projects while keeping my team focused on the day-to-day. It's hard to keep up.
Jeepers, Dad. Why don't you call Maris? They're the staffing firm with the best technical resources around. They helped Billy's dad. He used to be stressed out like you. He was missing deadlines, his team was overworked, and a bunch of folks left the company because it was too stressful. But then he called Maris. And they put resources to work right away. He hit all his deadlines and freed up his team to do other work. His boss was so happy that Billy's dad got some extra time off.
Time off? Wow. What did he do with that?
He spent it with Billy. Aww.
That's a swell idea, son. I'll call Maris today. Now, you go wash up for summer.
But you said, consulting's okay, but does my work stand the test of time? What can I do that kind of feels like it has more permanence to it? So where do you go from there?
Yeah, so it was kind of two things happened, Andrew, at the same time. We decided to move back to the US. And we also decided that I wanted to sort of, you know, be in a more longer term role. We also had our son. And so I couldn't really travel. A lot of what consulting just brings with it, right? Just different clients and things. And so, yeah, I found myself looking for this solutions architect role at a digital dentistry company that was just starting to disrupt the world of dentistry. So Align Technology, they were looking for a solutions architect, very similar in the work that I had done. They were looking to start automating their order to cash process. And that's where I joined as a solutions architect.
Can you describe for folks who don't know Align or Invisalign, like what it is, how it works, and why it was so disruptive?
Yes. So it was really taking on wires and brackets, right? So it was, you could straighten teeth, you could align your teeth with a piece of clear plastic in your mouth that you could take out when you needed to eat and drink, and that didn't have the discomfort of wires and brackets, that didn't have, you know, some of the maintenance that came with wires and brackets. I think it's truly disruptive because it really worked well. We have so many cases where, you know, patients were so happy. You know, we've had a number of patients tell us how their confidence improved dramatically when their smile was a smile that they were happy to show, right? And so I think it was disruptive because it was at the bleeding edge of what technology could do, then what materials and algorithms together could do. But then it also brought this sense of, you know, you doing something that people feel more confident with, that they have a better life with.
Well, as a wire and bracket braces survivor myself, I really wish Invisalign had been around in the 80s. As I understand it, they take a cast of your teeth and then they make a clear retainer that's basically the same shape. And then they kind of give you gradually straighter retainers to wear. Is that kind of how it works?
Yes, that's close. Yeah. So you could take a PVS impression, which is the cast, or, you know, a lot of dentists now use intraoral scanners. So we also make an intraoral scanner, so you can just digitally scan your teeth and you get that impression. And then, yeah, we give you a clear aligner. You typically wear that for about a week. And at the next stage, the next week, you get another aligner. And we know where your teeth, how your teeth are going to move. And so every stage of the aligner is built to where we expect the teeth position to be. And at the end of your treatment, we put you in a retainer, right? Because teeth eventually tend to move. And so we want you to be in a retainer so that we keep the position of the teeth as we've got them to.
If I were you guys, though, I'd ship everyone like 3 sets of the aligners because I imagine they get lost.
That's right. They do. And we have, you know, we have an ability within the product itself to order replacements and things. But yeah.
All right, so you land there in an individual contributor role, but your mentor/manager sees something else in you. What happens then?
Yeah. Like I said, we were, you know, working through these integrations of our order to cash. We were using TIBCO, and there was a team starting to form of the enterprise application integration team, so to speak, right? The EAI team. She needed a leader for that. She asked me to take the role. She thought I'd be a good fit. And I'd never led people, right? The consulting roles are sort of more independent. You go in, you do your thing, you come out. I really wasn't sure that I could do it. And I said, no, thanks a lot, but, you know, I'm good. And 2 weeks went by. I think she realized that she needed to sort of give me an ultimatum of sorts because she really, I think, believed in me, and thank God for that. But she came back 2 weeks later. She said, this is the last chance. I'm not going to ask you again, but I really think you're suited for this role. You should take it. I think that ultimatum kind of pushed me. I was like, wow, if I don't take it, I'm probably losing out on an opportunity that perhaps won't come by again. And so I did. And I'm so thankful for that because I truly love leading teams. I think that's my thing to do, is really finding the passion in each person, what they want to do, and then putting that together to form a team that's high performing and can deliver. Very, very thankful for that.
And so you're probably getting into the ERP side and figuring out, okay, wherever these aligners are made, how do we get them from a block of plastic to something useful? What's that like?
It was all the IT backend processes, Andrew. So the submission, you know, the website that doctors use to submit their aligners, getting the orders through to where you actually have a whole treatment planning process where technicians will plan the treatment for the doctor. So managing that workflow, then eventually presenting the plan to the doctor. We have a platform called ClinCheck that doctors use to review their treatment plans. They can make changes, they can submit the plan, and then there's sort of a back-end ERP fulfillment, as well as the manufacturing process of the actual aligners that happens. So yeah, my team was working through all of the integrations, figuring out how best to automate that and really make it touchless.
And so then you're tasked with kind of launching new products. Company's growing pretty rapidly. I think you guys were around $1 billion in revenue in this time frame. What happens then?
Yeah, so we're $1 billion in revenue, still much automation to do, but also lots of legacy applications. I think we were at a stage where we had multiple ERP platforms. We ran a digital transformation program that allowed us to combine multiple ERP platforms to a single platform and standardize the processes, right? Across, we were also becoming very global. As we were hitting $1 billion in revenue, we were becoming global. We were selling in different countries. So we needed to standardize our business processes and make sure there was one way to do things across all the regions. So yeah, worked through a fairly large transformation program that sort of got us to standard processes and standard platforms.
Company made some acquisitions around then too, right?
Yes. So we acquired a company called Cadent that made intraoral scanners and, you know, really wanted to move the dentists into a digital space. You get so much more accuracy and clarity when you digitally scan teeth versus, you know, the previous impressions. And it's also not something that's comfortable for the patients. So we were able to acquire Cadent, and with that came, you know, a whole different world of digital.
Having had to have done the several of those waxy bite down thingies for my bite guard, I wish they had a way to do that with the digital scanners.
Yeah, so that was a big add, a really good add to our portfolio.
Now, you end up taking a sabbatical after that, right?
I do. You know, and my son was just starting middle school. I think between my husband and I, we were both traveling. And there was one time we exchanged our son at the airport. You know, he was 3 years old in pajamas. I'm landing. My husband's going on a red eye. And we're literally like, oh, here you go. You know, exchanging him. And we were like, okay, I think we both, you know, need to take a step back and figure this one out. So I was ready for a break, took a sabbatical and had some wonderful experiences during that. I was completely sort of not working for 2 years and then working part-time for 1 year.
Yeah, that's when you got involved with Girls Who Code.
Yes. So wanted to do something, give back to the community, something in with women and in technology. So I started researching, and Girls Who Code had a number of clubs actually in the Bay Area. One of them started talking, and they were actually hosting a web design class, and they needed someone to, so they had the class going, but they needed someone to teach the class. And they were sort of trying to self-learn, but realized that wasn't really going very far. It is hard to motivate a group of elementary and middle school girls to code. You've got to make it interesting. And so I joined there as the instructor and taught them web design, you know, HTML, CSS, just a whole bunch of web design constructs there. It was actually really, really interesting because, you know, I'm thinking the girls are coming in, they're super motivated, they're just going to hit the ground running, I'm going to take out my course schedule, I'm going to go down each of the programs, then I'm going to ask them to build a website. No, I was completely faced with something that I'd never thought I'd faced with. The girls come after school, they're tired, they want to catch up with each other, they want to talk about what's happened in school. It's really hard to motivate them, right? So we kind of flipped things a little bit and we said, you know what, tell us what your passion is. Tell us what your interest is. Some girls were about the environment. Some girls were about social justice. Someone else was about music. And I said, okay, how about you guys build a website to talk about your passion, what you're interested in? And you could do whatever you want in the website. But in order to build it, you're going to have to learn HTML and CSS and everything else that goes with it. And you can learn just those pieces of what you want to build in your website. And I'm okay with that. And that was really cool because that motivated them. It was amazing to see what they mapped out in their screens and their wireframes. And then figured out what piece of, you know, HTML do I need to know in order to build this website.
There's always a question about, like, how young do you go in order to get them started? Like, you don't want to confuse the heck out of a kindergartner, but you don't want someone to like get so old. You mentioned on the pre-call, you want to engage them young enough before they get that fear or lack of confidence. So what was the kind of right window?
You know, I think it's late elementary, early middle school is, I think, right where kids are willing to take anything on. They don't have the fear of failing. They don't know what it is. They're open to anything that you throw at them. And I think that's the time to build a love for tech and do different things. Let them try it out. I think as they get older, there becomes a sense of, I have to be good at something to do more of it. And if you haven't gotten that platform to learn it and potentially be good at it, I think there tends to be some kind of hesitance.
I remember with my daughters, my wife and I remarking to each other when they were that young, late grade school, early middle school, like just say, oh, I wish I could bottle up this confidence that they have right now and deliver it back to them when they're teenagers.
Yes.
You know, when they're scared to try things or unsure or whatever.
It's fascinating how as time goes by, you turn into an adult who has just all these preconceived notions in their head I think it's important to bottle that up.
So when you decide to end your sabbatical, what do you do?
So I actually wasn't ready to go back to work full time. I wanted to find something that was part time. I had a coworker that worked at Align but left and joined Google. And I got an opportunity to work with Google Cloud in their Google Cloud Systems team, sort of similar to their IT backend team. And they were really sort of working to build out quotes for their Google Cloud customers. Quite a complex process, right? Because Google Cloud offers a number of different features, and really packaging that offering for each customer is a unique sort of individual process that the sales reps go through. And we wanted to build we were using Salesforce, and we wanted to build a process for them that would allow them to create their own quotes and then sort of go back and forth with the customer as they negotiated those, and then be able to process them to the back end when the customers were ready to sign.
So way back in episode 34 of Underserved, we talked to Jeremy Halperin, who was like an early GCP customer. And he said the thing that drew us to GCP was they were like kind of selling us a solution, whereas AWS was like, well, here's DNS and here's hosting and here's disk and here's a database. Go build something.
I think that's exactly right, right? Because you could package different features of GCP that perhaps on their own were disparate and not, you know, didn't understand how they fit into one single sort of offering based on what your customer needs were. And that's important, right? Really understanding your client and what their needs are, and then offering the right things from GCP, because there's so much, it's overwhelming, right? And now there's even more. And so you really have to, as a salesperson, think through what is that value for you? And then how do I make it attractive for you to start? And then as you scale, do more.
So just when you think you're done with Align technology, they pull you right back in. What happens?
Yeah. My ex-boss called me. You know, she used to manage all of IT, but then she also got the product software engineering team. And I had a role there leading sort of the customer-facing applications that we build sort of grounds up. And yeah, I couldn't resist that, Andrew. It was, when you're in IT, at least when I was at Align and part of IT, you always wanted to work on the product, right? You always wanted to interface with the doctors, work on things that were really sort of core for the company. And I couldn't resist that. So I had to sort of ask myself if I was ready to go back full time. And COVID had just started. I don't think any of us knew how long it was going to last. This was literally April of 2020.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I said, you know what? Let me give this a shot. I'm sure we'll be back in the office in a few months and I can meet everyone. And, you know, Align had grown tremendously in the 3 years that I was out, but I was looking forward to meeting everyone. Didn't realize it would be a couple of years before I could do that.
Yeah. Zoom's just not quite the same.
It's not.
So what sort of things are you working on now that you're concentrating on the product side?
Yeah. So working really on the customer-facing stack, Andrew. So this is, the portal that doctors use to submit their Invisalign cases, the treatment planning platform that doctors use to view their treatment plans. We have a product called Live Update that doctors can use to make changes in real time. It's truly fascinating, right? You could be sitting on a Saturday afternoon looking at a patient's treatment plan. You wanted to make a few tweaks to it. In the past, you had to run that by through a technician and wait for the technician to make those changes and send them back to you. With this software, you can now just make changes live. If they look good to you, you can see the results of those changes and you can approve on the spot, right? So it's given just a ton of freedom to our doctors to be able to work on the plans whenever they want to and be able to approve and then know that they're off to manufacturing and soon to get to them at the clinics.
And I think you had the aligner stages now, like the tightening it up so it's down to like a week for a stage.
Yeah, most of our aligners can be worn for just a week. So that's actually really cool as well. And then, we continue on even when a patient is in treatment. We want to make sure that we have software that allows you to monitor the patient's Invisalign treatment. So we have a product called Virtual Care that allows patients to take a photo of their smile. And we use AI guidance to help them take the right smile, right? To make sure the mouth is open enough. You can see the posterior teeth. It's well lit. You're at the right distance from your phone. We take those photos both with and without your aligners. And then we have machine learning algorithms that run to see if there's a space between the edge of the tooth and the edge of the aligner, which if there is, and we allow doctors to set their own thresholds, but if there is a space, that could mean that the patient's starting to go off track. And then this way we can inform the doctor can talk to the patient, perhaps have them come into the clinic. But if everything's going well, then you could just let the patient know that they're on track and they should just continue with their next stage. So that's some of the products the team works on.
So over the years, you've either as a hands-on developer or team lead or, you know, director and so on, VP. You've seen a lot of technology stacks. What are your favorites for like front-end, back-end, database? What do you think? What do you prefer?
So front-end, definitely React.js. I think that's something that I've used in multiple places. We do a lot of 3D visualization at Align, so we use a lot of WebGL for that. Backend, Java forever. And some of the folks, not even just at Align, but in general, I think Kotlin's picking up a lot for, of course, for mobile development, but even as a backend programming language. So we're starting to see a lot of that. Databases, Postgres for more of a relational database and Dynamo for more unstructured data. You know, I think in general, as a technologist and as a leader of teams, engineers would love to use all kinds of languages, right? I have a team that uses Rust or wants to use Rust. I think we're trying to, like, you know, keep the number of front-end, back-end databases to some minimal set so that we can scale as an organization. And I think that's what every organization is trying to do, is not sort of open the window up to whatever is sort of the next thing, but really keeping our eyes open as well on sort of what should be the next set of technologies to look at.
As a software developer myself, I understand the temptation whenever you're looking at a new project. Like, wouldn't it be cool if we used brandy new technology X on this thing? And oh, by the way, technology X has this new feature that's going to make this so much easier. Yeah. And that's just one tip of the iceberg as far as the decision process goes, from a building a team, maintainability, extensibility perspective. It's hard to not succumb to the hot new technology temptation.
It is. And that's really about maintainability and scalability. And that's kind of the reasons we try to keep it low. But then again, you have to look at what's new, right? And what might actually make sense to what you're trying to build. There could very well be a language that comes along that makes absolute sense, or a platform or a framework that makes absolute sense. I think you still got to evaluate and take a look. But I think there has to be some frameworks and guardrails. Otherwise, it's hard. It's hard to maintain.
You know, let them dream a little bit, give them a proof of concept, and then they can do a demo like you did back in the
day. That's right. As long as it doesn't wipe out the hard drive, which I guess now there isn't really a hard drive anymore.
Your SSD, whatever, your cloud storage, you can still wipe things out.
That's right.
Emma, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your experiences with all the listeners of Underserved.
Thank you for having me, Andrew. It was great being here.
And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.
Thank you for listening to the Underserved podcast. For more information on the topics discussed and for show notes, visit the show website, underserved.fm. And please be sure to rate, like, and subscribe to Underserved on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.